Hi, everybody. It's so nice to see you all. I'm Ava Chin. I'm the head of the American Studies Certificate Program. We are a program that is open to any graduate students here at the GC. So if you're interested in American Studies and interested in getting the certificate before you graduate, please come speak to me after the event. I am so pleased to introduce Professor Christine Vellante, who is an associate professor of performing and media arts and Asian American Studies at Cornell University. I'm going to give you a bit of her bio. She is the author of Tropical Renditions, Making Musical Scenes in Filipino America, which came out in 2016 by Duke University Press. And it received the Best First Book Award from the Filipino Studies Caucus of that AAAS. Her writings have been published in Women and Performance, the Journal of Asian American Studies, Women's Studies Quarterly, and Theater Journal. She is the co-editor of the Artist Scholar Anthology, California Dreaming. She'll be talking with us today about her current book project, Making Sense of Martial Law. Professor Vellante is the TAM Visiting Scholar here at the American Studies Certificate Program by way of ARI, the Asian American Asian Research Institute. We would like to thank ARI, which is one of our main co-sponsors, as well as the MA in Liberal Studies and the PhD program in Black, Race, and Ethnic Studies. So please give us a warm welcome to Professor Vellante. First of all, thank you again to American Studies, your grads, and especially Ava Chin, Shana Jalil, for setting up not just today's event, but really helping me navigate the theory administrative morass, or quagmire, as it were. You all have brought so much warmth and hospitality to this fellowship here, and I really, really appreciate it. Also to ARI, the folks there, Sonia Winshi, Diana Pan, Linda Varghese, and Anthony Wong. It's truly, I think especially for those who are professors in the room who know, kind of post tenure to just have the time to a year to come back to New York and to really just write and think and read. It's been such a privilege, right? And so I really, really appreciate that as well. And to you all for being here today, these former students from Cornell, other colleagues who, left their homes, which they usually do, on their own fellowship years. So just to kind of talk about today's form, I really thought of as more of a kind of show and tell. There's some newer stuff that I've been working on, particularly this year, and then some stuff from prior years. But I also want to think of it as a kind of thinking through or thinking alongside other folks in this room. So clearly you're here because you have some kind of interest in the topic. And also maybe it's coinciding with your own research. So again, I'd love to hear more. This is like total work in progress, not a be-all, end-all at all. Okay. So throughout their 21 years in power, from 1965 to 1986, former Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos and his wife Imelda crafted political spectacle along various sensorial lines. From their earliest political days on the presidential campaign trail, both the booming baritone from the provincial north and his charming songstress wife from the south invoked the auditory spectacles of singing, crying, and public speaking in order to touch the hearts of the Philippines electorate. Through these performances, the young political couple, as historian Vicente Rafael has noted, turned their private lives into public spectacles, staging a stylized version of their intimacy. During these early years of their political ascent, they also played upon the Filipino cinematic and celebrity trope of the love team, two star-crossed lovers starring in their own national romance. But after Marcos was elected in 1965, they crowned themselves the father and the mother of the Philippine nation, a gender framework captured in a painting that rendered them as malakas and maganda, so the strong and the beautiful, kind of Philippine mythological or folkloric version of Adam and Eve.
This, I realized the fiction of the first couple was shattered a few years later, however, when UP student activists got hold of audio sex tapes starring the president and his B-movie star mistress, Jodie Bean, and broadcast them over the university campus radio station airwaves. So portrayed in their early years as Asia's version of Camelot, by the end of their regime in 1986, the couple's corrupt and Catholic behavior was set in stark contrast to the austere, almost puritanical image of the Reagans. So for those of us old enough in the room to remember the 80s, also to remember the person who's about to step into our White House, who's also of that time period, we can understand, right, this kind of juxtaposition. The Marquis's material excess crystallized in that enduring and fetishistic symbol of course, Imelda, Madame's 3,000 pairs of shoes, a magnanimic and sensational rendering of extravagance in the face of national poverty. So just also thinking of the event of martial law's declaration in 1972 was Marcos's response to ongoing political opposition by students, rival politicians, longstanding communist and radical leftist groups against Marcos's political platform of a new society, one that was steeped in discipline and austerity and portrayed as a revolution from the center waged against the lawlessness and threat of communist factions and young people. By 1971, anti-Marcos sentiment was widespread within the country, both among everyday people as well as those in government. Such sentiments would make his 73 re-election more difficult, which led many observers to believe that Marcos himself was responsible for bombings that happened at Plaza Miranda, which led to the killing of various figures from his rival political party, the military National Guard's violent treatment of university student protesters during the first quarter storm, and for possibly the staging of his own kind of right man, Juan Ponce de León's assassination in September 1972, all as a means of creating scenes of lawlessness that then precipitated the need for martial rule. And of course, for those of us in the U.S., you know, on this past kind of presidential election season, we too kind of saw, right, what we would think of perhaps as well as staged performances, right, to set up a certain image of the presidential incumbent. Proclamation 1081 was signed on September 20th, 1972, but its public reading on television took place on September 21st. And as a program, martial law was also enacted through legal proceedings. The Supreme Court approved 1972 Constitution, which suspended civil and political rights, shrunk diminished civil court jurisdiction, expanded the reach of existing military courts, and increased the number of presidential decrees. That led to a less visible but more powerful military force, increased press censorship, and reform policies. Ironically, though, the martial law period is also remembered as one in which national arts and culture proliferated. So there was the building of the Cultural Center of the Philippines, the Manila Film Center, the Philippine High School School of the Arts, with the mandate that local radio stations play at least one original Filipino music tune per hour. So prior to this, there was no kind of quota or mandate. There was a lot of Western or American music. And of course, the financial support of avant-garde and social realist filmmakers who marked the second golden age of Philippine cinema. So the Marcos's new society imagined a whole new world for the senses, from visual performance art to musical performance, from film and literature to land reform. Like many other authoritarian figures, they played upon the sensational in order to simultaneously divert attention away from their covert operations, state-sanctioned political detainment, imprisonment, torture, and killing, while they also captivated audiences with invented traditions and national myths that upheld their new society. So I'm trying to attend to both Philippine as well as U.S.-based cultural performance and production, Making Sense, Poetics and Performance of Martial Law, the current book title, studies forms, narratives, and production histories in order to examine the deployment of political affects and emotions by different historical actors and towards different visions of political and social change. So Making Sense centers performance and media in its study of Philippine martial law under the first Marcos regime, as Alvin pointed out. Which Marcos is he going to talk about?
Well,
the first, but, you know, the second will always already come into play. In a manner distinct from social science studies, so political science, sociology, or development studies, Making Sense writes against the martial law common sense, a shared set of assumptions or classifications and descriptions that has and continues to make sense of the meaning of Marcos's authoritarian rule. And instead, I'm trying to kind of think through or argue for making sense, right? These methods and modes of perception and apprehension that point out or that underscore the ongoing production of political realities, histories, and performances. So Making Sense is actually a methodology that I am drawing from my studies of theater performance. As we scholars are summoned to imagine and reanimate events and performances that have passed, through an interplay between the archival, ethnographic, and ephemeral, I've been wrestling with the kinds of critical questions these artistic cultural events and their producers, which I'll talk about today, what kinds of questions do they raise, and asking what forms of memory work do they actually enact. In turn, for me, Making Sense is also about enlivening the past through our own writing, right, in order to imagine the past toward new political futures. So I guess that's just kind of more plainly to say, how can we write about this history or about these kind of artistic productions in a way that makes it kind of more palpable for today. And again, conversation with Alvin, it's not just Marcos in the Philippines authoritarianism, but, you know, unfortunately, or maybe fortunate for the writer here, it's something closer to home. So this project is grounded in the field of performance studies, critical Filipino and Filipino-American studies, and Southeast Asian studies. It's in conversation with other scholars, artists, curators, and critics who work in the Philippines and Southeast Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean, who are against current and historical authoritarian regimes. Making Sense synthesizes theories of cultural memory and political feeling with materials and analyses that diversify U.S.-based scholarship on authoritarianism. Currently, this scholarly conversation has been focused on Latin American context, and often frames the Philippines as different or exceptional to mainstream conversations on U.S.-backed authoritarian regimes, right? So as one of my students kind of notes, right, when we taught or taught a Fictions of Dictatorship class, it's quite easy for U.S. historians to kind of talk about, you know, Argentina or Chile, maybe even Cambodia, right? But something like the Philippines, right, where they're so, the U.S. is so instrumental, right, in that regime, often kind of gets pushed under the rug. Right? So I'm also indebted to and in conversation with the work of critical Filipino and Filipino-American studies scholars such as Josin Diaz, Talitha Espiritu, Lucy San Pablo Burns, Jose Capino, Roland Golentino, and many others. So again, the timeliness of this project is marked by the return of the Marcos family into power with the election of Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos Jr. to the presidency in 2021, and of course Trump in 2024, and the broader global uprising of authoritarianism across the globe. As many scholars and critics have noted, this return points us to the power of social media. It is a platform for disinformation and misinformation. This phenomenon takes place on a larger political playing field of remembering and educating younger generations about Philippine martial law history, both in the U.S. and the Philippines itself, where the Enhanced Basic Education Act of 2013 actually removed Philippine history from high school curriculum. And it's really ironic to kind of note that Noynoy Aquino, right, the son of the slain political opposition leader, was the president during this time when this kind of historical revisionist act was established. So in the end, this book argues that the work of remembering and becoming educated about Philippine martial law does not lie just upon the Filipino people, their children, their diasporas, but also upon those of us living in places and nations impacted by cultural productions authorized, inspired, and created by the U.S.-backed Marcos regime. Okay, so this is kind of clunky, and this again maybe be for more for the graduate students, or the I guess junior faculty. I'll also say in this past year, no shame, I've been working with a developmental editor, right, to kind of, because I started with these chapters and figuring out some, you know, what is the story that I wanted to tell about each of them. And then after a while, I had a bunch of stories, like, what am I trying to argue or do here, right, in the larger project? And so this is kind of a paragraph, right, that she, developmental editor, has kind of talked about as a kind of scholarly algorithm, right, as a kind of way of centering one's project. So Making Sense, the Poetics and Performances of Martial Law is about what the diverse poetics of Philippine martial law perform and teach us about authoritarianism, as illustrated by how U.S. and Philippine-based performers and productions engage with the Marcos regime. So it's arguing that the ways these artists and producers engage with the U.S.-backed Marcos regime illuminates how the Marcoses mobilize arts and culture in service of its political needs, and how artists mediated specific kinds of audience and participant experiences towards different political ends. So significantly, the examination of these artists and their work during and or about this regime illuminates important facets of the intersection between arts and politics in authoritarian regimes across the world. And so right now, I kind of just want to point out, just being really honest, that I know it feels very like kind of AI generated in terms of like it's very broad, right? But, you know, again, it's kind of a touch point, right, or kind of touchstone as I'm continuing with this project and hoping to then refine, right, this paragraph as time goes on. So again, as I mentioned earlier, this really is a work in progress. And so as we go through the three chapters, if I will, I really ask for you all if there are any connections that you're feeling or resonances with other kind of geopolitical or geocultural contexts or examples, please feel free to jot them down. We can talk more about them in the Q&A. All right, so chapter one, what does this all have to do with Coconuts and Rice? Jose Maceda and the Philippines, the Cultural Center of the Philippines and Filipino Avangard. So Jose Montserrat Maceda was born in Pila in 1917. A piano prodigy who could play classical repertoire with natural ease as a musician Akiunga notes, Maceda was sent to the Academy of Music of Manila, then to the Conservatory of Music, Conservatory of Music at the University of the Philippines, before embarking on his studies abroad. Due to more than three centuries of Spanish colonization, Western music was fairly rooted in Filipino culture, and it was not unusual to receive a Western-style education, end quote. So Maceda's overseas education began in Paris from 1937 to 1941 with world-renowned pianist, conductor, and teacher Alfred Cortot. Returning to Manila in 1947, composer and researcher Michael Tenzo recounts, quote, Maceda played a series of recitals featuring Beethoven's Appassionata Sonata before many of Manila's cosmopolitan acolytes of European culture. And in preparing and performing, as he told Tenzer, he was repeatedly provoked by this voice inside of him, posing what was for him an epiphanic and previously unasked question. What does all this Beethoven have to do with coconuts and rice? So here we kind of see this inner sense of contradiction and conflict. And perhaps this was just another way of asking, what have Western musical values to do with Asian ones? What has composition to do with ethnomusicology? And what had placed him, Maceda, in the position of feeling impelled to resolve these issues? So after World War II, he continued his overseas musical piano education, which led him here to the U.S. He did private piano study with E. Robert Schmidt in San Francisco, and he went on to study musicology actually here in New York at Queens College and then Columbia University. And it was here where he found a new interest in ethnomusicology and Filipino indigenous music. But within another kind of context, right? Because while he was here in New York, he also visited with Edvard Varese, a French composer who spent the majority of his career in the U.S. and defined his music's aesthetic as organized noise and incorporating into his compositions, electronically generated sounds and non-musical noises, such as sirens. Apologies. Actually, Varese was doing this with his music. So Masada conceived of his musical compositions then as sound masses, where the importance of individual pitches was minimized in preference for texture, timbre, and dynamics as primary shapers of gesture and impact. Masada was introduced to musique concrète, the experimental technique of musical composition, using recorded sounds as raw material, with Pierre Schaeffer, and he befriended the French-Greek composer Ioannis Xenakis, both of whom had worked closely with Varese in the past. So art historian Tina Lay writes, while it is unclear if Masada had actually attended the performance of John Cage's 433, as a music student in New York, he undoubtedly had heard about it. Right? So this is, again, giving you a context that he's moving from a kind of Western classical tradition of training to now something that's more of a kind of modern, conceptual mid-century, right, type of musical training, which he will then kind of take back to the Philippines. So returning to the Philippines in 1952, Masada actually began exploring and documenting the world of pre-colonial indigenous music as an ethnomusicologist. He had fieldwork that took place over a decade, and he formed a team of researchers who carried these very heavy tape recorders across mountains and seas in the countryside of the Philippines to study ethnic music traditions. Soon, his study extended beyond the Philippine nation into neighboring geographical regions in Southeast Asia and East Asia. From 1961 to 1963, he came back to the U.S., conducted doctoral work in ethnomusicology at UCLA, where he completed a dissertation on fieldwork in the Philippines by recording local instruments and music throughout the archipelago. So I present to you this short biography for Masada to acquaint those of you unfamiliar with him and his work, but also to provide a common, well-treaded framework for talking about him. In the Philippines, up until today, Masada is remembered both as a beloved professor and mentor for young Filipino composers. Yet, what is often conveniently overlooked, or perhaps just kind of brushed under the rug, is the fact that he was one of a cadre of Cultural Center of the Philippines artists whose work was premiered and funded, right, by the Marcos regime, and specifically by Imelda Marcos herself. Right? So there's kind of excerpts of three of his major works. The first was Lut. What you see is a kind of, I guess, a script, right, or a diagram for these kind of large-scale sound performances that he would do. And so the first kind of instance of it, the rehearsal of it, took place at the University of the Philippines, Diliman. This is kind of the entrance, like right in front of the administration building. The second, one of the other performances he did, called Cassette 100, took place in the context of the Cultural Center of the Philippines lobby. And as you can see, it was kind of more evocative of the happenings that were happening here in the U.S. or across the globe during the time period. And then finally, like, one of his very last performances, Unayan, was basically a composition that took place over the radio, and that he wanted to kind of spread beyond just Manila, but, you know, to the kind of nearby provincial regions. And in each of these aspects, it's indigenous music, right, that is playing, that's either playing or that is either the kind of content of the work. But the ideas are very much more experimental, avant-garde, right, of their time period. So as you can tell here, this premiere, right, would not have been possible across Philippine radio without Madame's support, right? And so as art historian Tina Lea actually talks about, it's basically that Imelda was very much enamored by modernist art ideas, even though she herself did not understand them. So taking all of this into consideration, Masetta's work and legacy are complicated and actually offer the researcher, myself, both a problem and a choice. How do I discuss his work so as to attend to its meaning for and as Filipino avant-garde performance, while not overlooking its and his relationship, right, to the regime? So as I've been researching and writing more about Masetta this year, what's actually popped up as a key word, whether I like it or not, is complicity. Right? So let me be clear, there's difficulty for me here in taking on this keyword, mainly because of the moralizing tone or register in which complicity, and especially artistic complicity, is often considered. Honestly, I think it's also difficult, right, as a person in diaspora, to discuss the complicity of Philippine-based artists, as well as a scholar to discuss the complicity of artists who are just trying to get their work made, right? I think complicity here also becomes difficult, tricky, when one reviews, listens to, and thinks alongside these works, and particularly the Cassette 100, which actually is doing a type of political work that countered or counters the regime. So in that, it was very much more about sound and noise, right, within this kind of austere lobby of the Cultural Center of the Philippines. And as Tina Lay, the art historian, notes, also there's a way in which it's rehearsing both protest and a lawlessness, right, that is against the regime. So there is a way in which the work is doing that, and also it's because it was so successful, so known in the region, and known just as a kind of art historical moment, it also furthers, right, in all this dream of the Philippines being seen as a kind of modernist haven. But to not think through complicity would also add to the historical and cultural amnesia of Philippine martial law, while also not engaging head-on with the ongoing structures and practices in its aftermath. So complicity is there now. I'm still kind of trying to work through it. And the next steps of this chapter is really just to visit Masetta's collections. Again, we have some at UCLA, but also at the University of the Philippines, both of the ethnographic field work and his performances. But I think it's also, I have this desire to talk to his former colleagues, who may be his students, about his legacy, right? And try to see if we can get on record, right, how they made sense of his role, right, within the regime. Okay, chapter two. Apocalypse, revisiting Apocalypse Now in a time and place of Philippine martial law. And I include here, it's actually kind of this chapter first started as an online journal article, which created the QR code, so if folks want to read through it, can visit that there. So my interest in research and writing about, of course, the epic canonical Hollywood film Apocalypse Now actually started with my viewing of the documentary Hearts of Darkness and Angel Velasco Shaw's Asian Americans in War Class when I was in grad school. So again, for grad students to know, the things that haunt you in grad school will live with you for many decades. And that's a good thing, right? Also to say you don't have to all write it now, like there will come a time, right, you can return to it. So what this means is I've always understood this film, both within the context, right, of the history of the U.S. war in Vietnam, of course, and the kind of cultural complex, right, as Viet Nguyen would call it, the kind of cultural industrial complex of Vietnam War within the global imaginary. But I've also understood it within the history of Philippine martial law. Right, and here I want to give a nod to Roland Tolentino and Lucius and Pablo Burns, right, whose work really kind of points out that during this time period, you know, there was a war, of course, between the U.S. and Vietnam, but this was also a time of martial law, and there was a kind of triangulation that's happening between the U.S., the Philippines, and Vietnam. But then as I continued my work as a scholar and teacher of Asian American studies, every time I'd encounter any writing on Apocalypse Now, either it focused on, of course, the on-screen representations and meaning, a mode of analysis which often left the Philippines, right, the site of the film's actual production, out of the film's analysis and discourse. Or, of course, the film would be understood in terms of its meaning within Coppola's own story as an auteur filmmaker. But, you know, so this is kind of what I dealt with for many years, even though my entry point to the film was quite different. And then, you know, as time went on, I actually encountered visual artist Stephanie Suhuko's video installation called Body Double, where, as you can tell from the various titles, she talks about, she kind of shows or helps us think through, right, what does it mean that the Philippines stands in for, right, Vietnam in all these kind of canonical Hollywood films, and how does that kind of undo, right, even our understanding of the Philippines as terra nullius, right, within this context. And I also happened upon the Filipino indie film Apocalypse Child, whose plot and storyline actually rests upon the myth of Apocalypse Now's home production, but at the same time is reminding, right, viewers that the fact that the film's shooting sites are actually these local sites within the Philippines, right? So it's not like we think Philippines, whole nation, and they're like, no, there are places like Baler in Aurora, or Pasadena, and so on, and other spots in Zambales, right? And so the plotline of this is there is the main character, Ford, who's kind of a, I don't want to say loser, kind of like a surf bum guy, teacher. And supposedly, right, the myth is that he is one of the offsprings, right, of the director and his mother. You can watch the film and find out if that's true. So with all of those things in mind, in 2019, pre-pandemic, I actually traveled to Baler, despite of the infamous Charlie Don't Surf scene. And then I was faced with a myth of both Hollywood and Indie Manila filmmakers. The visit made me feel that it was important to analyze the film both through the stories of Philippine locals, be they surfers, visual artists, or film production people, as well as a jumping off point for considering the conditions of possibility for the film's making, right? So it's to say, you know, often in production studies, they talk about, I can give an example now, maybe others can think of them. But sometimes when there's a film that's made, right, in a certain area, there's a whole kind of cottage industry, right, that will build a kind of tourist, like, oh, come to the site of where we filmed Apocalypse Now. And I imagined in my head, and this is kind of what Apocalypse Child pushes, is that that's how it would be visiting Baler, and it's not. Like, there was one cafe that had a poster up, and that was kind of, you know, that was it. So that was my own fantasy. But also when I talk about the conditions of possibility for the film's making, right, it's the fact of that Marcus's practices and policies and military infrastructure, right, so the film is made in 1975. The war has just ended. Clearly, Coppola cannot go to Vietnam to film the film. Next closest thing, he needs the look, right? But, and also, because of, you know, the U.S. military presence, we have U.S. military machinery, right, and infrastructure. So you can borrow helicopters that are actually from the U.S. Yeah, it's just a total backlot situation. Also, Marcos really at this time is trying to develop tourism, and a particular tourism around film production, right? So this is also become a condition of possibility for Coppola to use the space. We can also think about, you know, the long history of U.S. cinema and filmmaking in the Philippines, right? Again, because of U.S. Imperial presence there. But also refugee humanitarianism, right? So the Philippines becomes a site of refugee relocation. Both Vietnamese and Cambodian refugees, and actually as a New York City-based poet, Kathy Che has a new video project, right, where she talks about her parents as refugees who were stationed in the Philippines on U.S. military bases during this time, and were kind of, I don't want to say invited, rounded up, gathered to play extras, right, on this film. So that also is a condition of possibility. And then finally, the indigenous groups who for those of you familiar with the film, who are somehow incorporated or their places in the Philippine nation state, they too become extras, right, in this Hollywood film. That's supposedly about Vietnam, but I'm kind of arguing a lot more about Philippine martial law. So as I wrote in that 2022 essay for Filipina, in May 1979, Francis Ford Coppola famously declared at Cannes, at the press conference, this wasn't just a film about Vietnam, this was Vietnam. With the U.S. military presence during the war, the film's production was also in a jungle. There were too many of us, Coppola said, too much money and too much equipment. Coppola's statement was made even more ironic because the film's headquarters in Belair had much of the social realism of a small-scale military base. So again, for those who think about film's production, they were housing about 700 foreigners. The enclave was actually guarded by Philippine constabulary troops against potential trespassers, namely the NPA, or the New People's Army and Communist Forces, that were rumored to be in the region. So in the end, Apocalypse Now consisted of 238 days of principal shooting at a final cost of $20 million, which ironically is the same amount of money that the U.S. paid Spain in 1898 for the transfer of the Philippines from one colonial set of hands to the next. Through sustained metaphor and extra-textual irony, the Hollywood film's production history and location shoot served as the perfect allegory for the American quagmire. Unlike what we might assume about the well-oiled machine of Hollywood, this film shot on location actually required much improvisation and thinking on its toes, amidst conditions both uncontrollable and exploitative, akin to other runaway productions made in the Third World with the nation's labor, land, and resources. So what this means is it actually faced a number of production obstacles due to natural as well as human-made causes. In the early days of the film's pre-production, there were casting issues. And then during the production, the military helicopters that had been promised by Marcos often had to be called back to fight communist insurgents in the country. So again, the New People's Army and the Moro National Liberation Front. So yes, they were kind of props within Coppola's film, but they were actually actively being used at the time to fight, the anti-Marcos groups, right, in the country. In addition, and for those of us from Southeast Asia will know, a particularly strong monsoon season became another element that the production had to battle. At first, Coppola was trying to incorporate, right, the monsoons, the typhoons, into the film. But then he realized, right, that the scale of destruction after Typhoon Olga, the director and his cast were forced to move operations from Belair, from one part of the country, to Sanjan, where both local and visiting production crews had to rebuild certain sets, including this, Kurtz's compound, over the course of 2 months. So this natural disaster actually cost them cost the budget $1 million. And then to make matters even worse, Coppola's film and screenplay actually lacked an ending, right? The final scenes of the now landmark film, set to The Doors, right, the end, this is the end, depended upon hours of conversation between Brando and Coppola in the midst of tropical humidity. He was improvising sequences with Brando at set. And then finally, serendipitously, the indigenous tribe Ifugaos actually performed a canal or a ritual or a ritual killing, right, of a carabao, a water buffalo. And that actually provided, right, Coppola a dramatic frame for the film's final montage. So for this, I'm still thinking about visiting, now that I've been to Belair, that's one of the sites, but also Sanjan Falls, and trying to interview, right, Philippine-based production crew to kind of hear their side of the story. Chapter 3, this is the final chapter. Why Don't You Love Me? A feminist killjoy approach to idealized love. And maybe this resonates more with New York folks since the Broadway run recently took place. So last but not least, for better or for worse, idealized love is actually the performance that first helped me formulate my interest in exploring in this book the relationship between history through authoritarianism, poetics through the sensorial, and politics. I have followed the show since it was a song cycle performance at Carnegie Hall. Then it became a CD-DVD collection, then an off-Broadway premiere at the Public Theater, and then, of course, the Broadway run. So you really got to give it up to David Byrne for creating a long tail of one project for your performance. So an immersive musical theatrical experience that created by Byrne, Fat Boy Slim, and director Alex Timbers, Here Lies Love stages former Philippine First Lady Imelda Marcos's rags-to-riches tale on a disco dance floor, with infectious pop tunes performed by a live band and sung by an all-Asian-American, predominantly Filipino-American cast. Its 360-degree scenic and video environment, from kitschy tropical island backdrops to walls of television screening interstitial titles, historical documentary footage, and close-ups of actors and audience members that are captured by roving, surveilling cameras. Here Lies Love places this audience in the center of action and engages them sensorially, perhaps even overwhelming them. As the Guardian's critic Alexis Polovsky writes, as you're surrounded by and involved in the action, it becomes more difficult to judge or be critical of these characters. You're dancing with Imelda, and it makes you more likely to sympathize with her and her husband Ferdinand, despite knowing better. By focusing on the Marcos regime's theatricality and myth-making, Byrne and Timbers stage the Philippine nation through melodramatic suffering. And I'll also say, I don't think I'm giving anything away, but also the melodrama is the staging of the love triangle, right, which is kind of, you can tell me otherwise, it's kind of still seen as a kind of gossipy note to Philippine history, but supposedly a love triangle between Imelda Ninoy Aquino from their youth and then Ferdinand Marcos, right, that somehow that's what's impelling her to be this kind of political figure. In Here Lies Love, as David Byrne's official biographer describes, quote, the biographical and psychological reality of Imelda Marcos is combined with the political history of the Philippines, unquote. So in the process, the show draws audiences away from the Philippines as an actual place and political project, and I would argue, then, therefore, from the culpability of the U.S., right, in Philippine politics, particularly during this time period. So the focus on this love triangle, on the people in this kind of tropical place, also takes away from the actual historical evidence that the U.S. is very much, again, involved during this time period. But for those of you who haven't seen the show, just to give you a little taste of the fact that this is supposed to be referencing or building upon disco music or ideas of disco. But as you can hear, especially in that the last kind of song, the titular song, right, it's still really within the kind of mode of Broadway musical sound, right? I have a whole other thing about Byrne and his version of disco being much more like about the Bee Gees than Sylvester, but we can talk more about that. So watching the show on Broadway most recently, my ideas and analyses then started to further congeal. So now, after viewing it and thinking about it this past year, I want to consider it within the history of the American Broadway musical genre. Second, I want to consider its staging and form within Broadway's current move toward immersive theater tools and techniques, ones that promise audience participation and cultivate neoliberal feelings and constructed history. And specifically, I'm interested in how the show uses projected images as kind of a shorthand for setting as well as narrative, and then therefore the image's theatrical and political impact in flattening and representing history without context, as well as the ways in which the show does a kind of choreo policing, right? And I borrow from Andrea Lopecki, which strangely mirrors martial law's disciplining and control of movement. So it's kind of harder to see in the trailer, but for those who've seen the show, you know, with this kind of moving stage called the blender that's in the middle and people there, you actually have ushers, right, in these kind of, what do you call it, air traffic control jumpsuits that are telling people in the audience, right, where to go. The third, I guess, in some ways, part of maybe the choreo policing or sensorial policing is a kind of overwhelm, right, of the sensorial, right, to the point that one cannot kind of make sense fully. You're kind of being guided through the narrative and the, again, the immersive experience that Byrne and that voice Lynn and Timbers want you to have. And then third, I now want to consider the show within the context of Bumbum Marcos's 2022 election, as well as the disinformation, misinformation, and historical revisionist campaign, both during and after his election, that took place online and are now taking place within curriculum. And then this third part is really just kind of, again, drawing from immersive theater's technique, right, or kind of nod to the Internet of Things, right? Which is to say, I want to argue that with the kind of the shorthand of these images, it's doing a similar work, right, to the kind of TikTok videos, which were taking kind of historical footage of Imelda Marcos and framing her as this sympathetic, right, or empathetic kind of character. So, at the same time, I needed to reckon with an obstacle that emerged for me as both a researcher and a member of the Filipino American community. And it was the way that the show's success was actually placed upon Filipino America's wholesale acceptance, as well as burden of promoting the show, all the different ways we were called upon to authenticate this performance event. Right? So, at the one hand, it is, and just from hearing some kind of activists within local groups, there was a community night, right, where folks were allowed to see the show for free in previews, and they were then told, like, you have to go tell, you know, your aunties and your lolas and your tita to come see the show, which cost at least $150 a ticket, right, that it was kind of placed upon, right, Filipino Americans to attend. And that's not just a kind of economic, great burden, but also then by us being there in the space or sitting in, you know, the space, I want to argue is we're kind of authenticating that, yes, we kind of agree with or are interested in, right, this version of that history. So it was here that I stumbled upon, yet again, Sarah Ahmed's notion of the feminist killjoy. And through the feminist killjoy, I've been able to parse out the mixed feelings, emotions, and sensational politics that I experienced while participating in that show, as well as the post-show conversations and dialogue that happened, you know, online and as well as in person. In the end, I started to explore how the givens of this Broadway musical are given to us, right? Through projections of archival historical moments, the overwhelming physicality of these Filipino performing bodies, the saturation of a dance music-driven soundtrack, and within a space that simulates both disco, right, and then, of course, registers a type of freedom, as well as, again, policed movement. In Ahmed's terms, Here Lies Love was sensational as I witnessed a range of ways my own, and the collective audience's senses were magnified even after the events of the show. On the one hand, like my fellow audience members, I too wanted to celebrate the sheer pleasure and joy of having all these Filipino and Filipino-American actors in a show, especially in an industry where opportunities still remain too far and too few and far between, right? And again, particularly to be Filipino, playing a Filipino character. But on the other hand, I was thrown, right, on that kind of terminology by Here Lies Love, as I experienced this world, the one that it created through immersive theater, as a kind of sensory intrusion. It was an event that promised and felt like too much, and therefore not enough. So with complicity now as a kind of active key word, I'm interested in continuing to argue and write about Here Lies Love's complicity as it builds upon and therefore reinforces the Imelda myth. Right? And here I'm trying to, I'm borrowing this notion of the Imelda myth from the Evita myth, right? That Latin American scholars have written about, and written about in particular, again, with Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber's 1970s Evita the musical, right? Which of course we can see as predecessors to this show. By doing so, I see the show as part of the broader media cultural landscape, as I mentioned, of misinformation and disinformation about the Marcos regime, one that, whether David Byrne and Fatboy Slim and Alex Timbers know, actually revises history through its emphasis on an approach to Imelda, Ferdinand, and Philippine politics more broadly. That's kind of, I have no formal ending, no final thoughts. Again, as I mentioned, I'm open to questions and thoughts.